You are listening to an exclusive podcast from Pituitary World News.
Good evening, folks. This is Dr. Lewis Blevins of Pituitary World News, podcasting from the Sea Ranch, California, on Sunday, August 30. And, of course, it's the year 2015, for those of you who are keeping track. Today, I would like to address some of your questions over the past few weeks, and I'll specifically talk about two topics. The first one, pituitary pathology, and the second one, the long-term effects of steroid treatment on the adrenal glands. The first question posed was actually about the Ki-67, otherwise known as the MIB-1, labeling index that was seen on a pituitary pathology report. So let's talk about that, but first let me introduce you to pituitary pathology. And we'll talk specifically about pituitary adenomas. So when the surgeon operates, they usually send one or more chunks of tissue, sometimes the entire tumor, to the pathologist for analysis. Sometimes the pathologist does what's called a frozen section analysis, where they freeze the tissue and cut through it with a very sharp knife and then look at that under the microscope. And that's largely just to confirm whether there's actually pituitary adenoma in the specimen. It can give a hint to whether there might be an inflammatory process or some other disease process. But generally speaking, it's a preliminary study and it's not that reliable in the long run as far as I'm concerned. I've seen far too many things changed by the subsequent pathology or the formal final pathology. And tissue is just simply best when it's looked at in a traditional manner that's not related to frozen section. So the first thing that happens when that tissue comes out is it's basically put in formalin and fixed or pickled, if you will. And the specimen, after about a week or so, is then prepared in a special process where they get rid of some of the fats and other things in the tissue and infuse, if you will, paraffin oil into the tissue. And then it's basically in a wax block, and it can be cut very thinly with a microtome. Slides can be made for analysis under the microscope. The old tried-and-true traditional first thing that's done is to look at it under a hematoxylin and eosin stain, and that can give some characteristics about the types of cells, and certain pituitary tumor types, for example, are going to stain more blue and others are going to stain more reddish-orange with those particular stains. So that really can be the first clue to the confirmation of what type of tumor is present. Another stain that you might see on your pathology report is the reticulin stain. We do know reticulin is one of those types of fibers or connective tissue fibers that's forming part of the structural network of the tumor, so to speak, and all normal cells as well. And pituitary adenomas and their growth pattern disrupt the normal reticulin pattern. So the pathologist will be able to see that that's actually fractured and not normal, and that's how they can tell a normal from a pituitary adenoma specimen, because frankly they both look a lot alike under the microscope, normal tissue and tumor. So sometimes that reticulin stain is the only way to confirm that an adenoma is actually present. Now, you've probably all heard the term immunochemistry or immunochemical analysis of pituitary adenomas. And the way this works, I'll use growth hormone as an example. So there are special antibodies against growth hormone. And if you have a growth hormone-producing tumor, putting that antibody on the slide, antibody will bind to the growth hormone-producing cells and stick to them is basically what happens. And then they use a second antibody that has immunoperoxidase on it, and or at least is peroxidase, so it can be detected looking at its brown character under the microscope. But that antibody is against the other antibody. So if you have growth hormone staining and then use the immunoperoxidase antibody, you'll get the brown staining. If the tumor didn't have growth hormone staining, that first antibody wouldn't stay, so the second one wouldn't have anything to bind to. So it's sort of a double antibody technique to detect different proteins in the cells. And we're able to do all sorts of things. We can check for LH, FSH, now people are using sort of what we call steroidogenic factor 1 to detect the gonadotroph adenomas, growth hormone to detect acromegalic patients, or at least to see if there's growth hormone secretion, prolactin antibodies for prolactinomas, ACTH antibodies for Cushing's, for example. And but each one of these tests is an antibody against a protein, and then there's another antibody against an antibody, and if the second antibody shows up, then that tells you the first antibody bound, and that's how this process works. So we can tell the cell type of a tumor based on those characteristics. We can do a number of other things. For example, we can look at antibodies against the SSTR2 receptor, and that's basically the somatostatin type 2 receptor, and that receptor positivity can be correlated with a clinical response to somatostatin analogs, and we actually do that at UCSF now. And then our antibodies against PIT1, which is a protein that can be seen in some developmental abnormalities of the pituitary gland. And then there's also an antibody against P53 that's a tumor marker, if you will. P53 is usually not expressed in benign tumors, and it's more likely to be expressed in malignant tumors. Generally, its expression in pituitary adenomas would indicate that the patient has either an atypical adenoma or a carcinoma. So let's get to the original question. What is the Ki-67 or the MIB-1 labeling index? So this is basically one of these antibody techniques where you stain for the Ki-67 antigen, and it's an antigen that's expressed in cells that are either actively dividing, have recently divided, or are preparing to divide. So it's going to be positive in all cells that are in the process of dividing or growing. And it's going to be negative in cells that generally are quiescent or not in the phase of replicating or growing. Interestingly, pituitary adenomas, the normal pituitary gland is a tissue that does not turn over very rapidly. Less than 0.5% of cells would have a positive MIB-1 labeling index. So it's a very metabolically inactive gland as far as growth is concerned, but it's certainly pumping out a lot of hormones throughout the day. Benign pituitary tumors usually have a labeling index somewhere around 0.5 to 2.5%, meaning that that 1/2 to 2.5% of the cells are in that phase of dividing or having divided or going to divide. We do know that cancers are usually in excess of 10 to 12%, and in my view, anything between 2.5 and 12% is sort of atypical in a tumor that raises my eyebrows. With I think most centers considering atypical adenomas to be over probably 3 to 5%. The thing that you need to know about this particular test is that it used to be done manually. In many places, it still is done manually, where the pathologist will count the number of cells that stain and the ones that don't, and then determine this index. But that's subject to a lot of error, depending on how tired the person is and how many cells they've been looking at and other things they've been looking at that day. But now a lot of places automate it with a computer, where the computer actually does the counting. And interestingly, when people started using automated counting for this, that's when the percentages of what was significant and what was worrisome actually started to change. So for example, we only used to worry about tumors that were over about 12%. Now we start to worry about tumors that are over 2.5 to 5%. And I think that this is one consequence of the fact that it's now done with a computer doing the counting. Another thing to keep in mind is that I see a lot of patients with very large tumors that have invaded bone and destroyed structures, and their MIB-1 labeling index will be 1%. So I think it's important to keep in mind that the sampling depends on what part of the tumor was removed, and we're actually looking at that to see what's the variation within a particular tumor. Because I think that it depends on what part of the tumor is actively dividing as to where you'll see a higher index or a lower index if it's a more quiescent area of the tumor. The other thing to keep in mind is that these tumors do seem to grow in fits and starts, and we see patients who have residual disease that will follow for years, and their disease will be stable, and then between, say, years 4 and 5, the tumor might double in size. So the labeling index, I think, more or less reflects the biology or the behavior of the part of the tumor that was sampled at the time when it was sampled, and it doesn't tell you anything about how aggressive that tumor was in the months leading up to the surgery where the tissue was acquired, or how aggressive it's going to be in the months to years following surgery. But we consider it to be a fairly reflective figure or data point for patients who have pituitary tumors, because there have been correlations that show that the levels are higher in patients who have invasive tumors and higher in cancers. The highest I've ever seen, I mentioned that normal pituitary is 0.5% or less. The highest I've ever seen in a pituitary adenoma was about 65% in a patient who died of his tumor. So this is something that can vary widely. You may see that on your pathology reports. That's what the KI-67 is about, and that's a brief introduction to pituitary pathology. Now, the next question I want to address was basically, can steroids cause atrophy of the adrenal glands if they're not required? And the straight answer is yes, they can. ACTH produced by the pituitary and CRH produced by the hypothalamus driving the pituitary to produce ACTH are necessary for the adrenal glands to be maintained in a normal responsive state. So, for example, ACTH stands for adrenocorticotrophic hormone, and that basically means a hormone that leads to growth and maintenance of the adrenal cortex. If you have pituitary disease and don't make ACTH, your adrenals will atrophy as a result, and that atrophy can take anywhere from about 6 weeks to 6 months to become apparent. The part of the adrenal cortex that's controlled by ACTH gets smaller and shrinks. The outer rind, which is controlled by the renin-angiotensin and aldosterone system, works fine. So your adrenals are still working, but the inner zones that respond to ACTH are not going to work. And that's if you have pituitary disease and require steroids. So you're going to have atrophy of the adrenal glands then. If you require steroids and take too much, they will further suppress that if you had partial adrenal insufficiency. But who really cares? If you're on steroids, you should take enough to be well. If you have normal function of the pituitary gland and take steroids, yes, you will see atrophy of the adrenal glands in that setting, and that can take a while to recover. It's generally thought, however, recent studies have debunked this a little bit, generally thought that the higher the dose and the longer the duration, and especially in patients who take steroids more than once a day, you might see greater atrophy and take longer to recover as a result of taking steroids if you have a disease process, for example, treated with steroids and then can ultimately come off the steroids. In those patients, the recovery is that the hypothalamus has to recover first, the adrenal glands have to, the pituitary gland has to recover second, and then adrenal glands can then be stimulated and wake up on their own. So it's really suppression of the hypothalamic pituitary unit that's the rate limiting step in those patients who take steroids for other disease processes and then develop atrophy of the adrenal glands. And I can see patients have recovery. I think the longest I've ever seen for one to recover, who actually recovered, was about a year and a half. Some patients taking steroids chronically will not recover at all over time and may require steroids for lifetime. My advice is that if you have central adrenal insufficiency due to the hypothalamic or pituitary disease, just understand that the part of your adrenal glands controlled by ACTH will be atrophic, and that's really nothing you can do about that except remember to take your steroids. If you're taking steroids for some other reason and your pituitary adrenal function is otherwise normal, just recognize that you may have adrenal insufficiency if you stop those steroids, so that you need to be transitioned to a shorter-acting steroid and work with a physician so that your steroids can be tapered to enable your pituitary and your adrenals to recover while you're receiving submaximal or subphysiologic doses of treatment so that your body has to make up the difference of what your daily needs are. And again, keep in mind that process can take a long time depending on the duration and the dose of steroid you've been treated with. And one last thing about this, it's important to keep in mind that injectable steroids, whether they're injected into an inflamed bursa, the spinal canal, or a herniated disc, or to a knee, they do get absorbed systemically and can suppress the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. Studies have showed that some patients who use inhaled steroids for asthma and allergies also can suppress their HPA axis as well. And I see this fairly regularly. I'll see patients who are diagnosed with adrenal insufficiency but have a normal pituitary MRI, and they're sent with a low cortisol and low ACTH, and they feel terrible. And it's suspected to be pituitary, but the patient looks a little Cushingoid. So you ask them, have you been taking steroids? And the answer is no. But then you find out that they've had maybe 6 injections of a long-acting steroid in their back within the past year, and that's why they look Cushingoid and have central adrenocortical insufficiency. It's simply because they've had another steroid shut down their pituitary function because they didn't need the steroid. And this whole system works because of the principles of negative feedback. The way the hypothalamus and the pituitary regulate all of our glands is to make minute-to-minute changes in hormone secretion so that cortisol levels will do what they're supposed to do, for example. And if you take steroids from outside, the hypothalamus and the pituitary say, wait a minute, we're seeing a lot of this hormone, so we don't need to tell the adrenal glands to make anything. And basically endogenous, or the amount produced from the body, gets turned off because the steroid is coming from outside. And if the dose is excessive, that's going to suppress that pituitary adrenal function for a much longer period of time. I think I've written on our website about steroid dose equivalents, but I'll recount them here for those of you who haven't seen it on a website. But the amount of hydrocortisone that a person should take to sort of mimic normal daily requirements would be roughly about 15 to 20 milligrams daily. The dose equivalent of dexamethasone to sort of meet that same amount produced is about 0.25 to 0.375 milligram daily. For prednisone, it's between 3 to 5 milligrams daily, and for methylprednisolone, it's between 7 and 9 milligrams daily. So if you've been taking more than those doses on any of those drugs, it's probable that you have suppression of your pituitary adrenal axis if you're being treated for a dermatologic condition or an arthritic condition or asthma or some other inflammatory disorder. And I use those doses as guidelines for replacement in patients who have hypopituitarism. So if you're on more than that, talk to your doctor about potentially lowering the dose, and especially if you've gained weight, developed stretch marks, have diabetes or hypertension. All right, that's it for this episode from Pituitary World News. Dr. Lewis Blevins, and I wish you all a very good night. Thanks for listening.